You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This network is supported by our listeners. You can become a supporting member by going to archpodnet.com/members and signing up. As a supporting member, you have access to high-quality downloads of each show and a discount at our future online store and access to show hosts on a members-only Slack team. For professional members, we'll have training shows and other special content offered throughout the year. Once again, go to archpodnet.com/members to support the network and get some great extras and swag in the process. That's archpodnet.com/members.
Hello and welcome to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 117 for August 16th, 2017. I'm your host, Chris Webster. On today's show, we talk about the violence in Charlottesville, Virginia on August 12th, 2017, and our thoughts on how history and heritage should be viewed and dealt with. So go learn something about someone else's history so you can widen your view of the world, because the CRM Archaeology Podcast starts right now. Welcome to the show, everyone. Joining me today are Sonia in Utah.
Hello.
Bill in California.
Hello.
And Steven in Canada.
Hello.
All right, so we had an entirely different topic planned for today, and it was going to be super exciting. It was going to change the world, and it was going to cause all kinds of hate mail and love mail to come into us. No, that's not true. Anyway, we decided, because we're recording this on Sunday, August 13th, yesterday on Saturday, August 12th in Charlottesville, Virginia, there was a huge protest against the removal of the statue of Robert E. Lee, who was the commander of the Confederate Army during the Civil War, the American Civil War, 1862 to whenever he surrendered. I don't know the exact date. But there's a whole bunch of, they're calling themselves white nationalists now, but they're, you know, everybody else is calling them Nazis. And I'll have a side note on Nazis and Indiana Jones here in a second. However, there was a massive protest, things on both sides. It wasn't supposed to start until noon, this whole demonstration thing, but it got kicked off well before that. And we'll have links to some of the articles in the show notes. But last I heard, 3 people had died and a bunch more people were injured. I know you guys can correct me on that, because I didn't get a chance to study this anymore, because we just decided to change to this topic immediately before recording the show. So, as you're hearing this, it was now about 5 days ago, if you're hearing this on the day that this came out. So what we wanted to talk about today was Charlottesville and heritage and history and kind of the sanitization of history and things that are going on and how, and I guess basically just how we feel about that. Now, just keep in mind, these are our opinions. We're not expecting anyone else to either agree or disagree with us. Well, we're expecting people to all do that, but, you know, we're not judging anybody or doing anything like that. So, let's just talk about this. First off, the Indiana Jones comment. Archaeologists online are always saying, we're not Indiana Jones, you know, because he was a looter and a pot hunter. However, everybody seems to be identifying with Indiana Jones now and putting up pictures of him shooting or beating up Nazis and saying, we got to use our other skills now. I just think that's funny how we appropriate our own cultural icons when it's convenient for us to do so, and not when it's not convenient for us to do so. So anyway, let's see. I think, Bill, you brought this up first when we first got on here about bringing this up as a topic. You woke up this morning to some more news articles, just like we all did. What are your initial impressions on this?
Well, first of all, I mean, my heart goes out, my sentiment goes out to the people who actually died over this.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of discussion about whether this was supposed to be a peaceful protest that turned violent, or whether they planned violence from the very beginning. I don't really listen to the alt-right stuff, so I don't understand or know what they were all planning or how it all came down. But we do know that thousands of people who call themselves alt-right individuals or politically right-leaning people who were trying to unite the right ended up in a situation where they were around a bunch of white supremacists. Maybe they actually are white supremacists, I'm not sure. At any rate, the protest was for removing the statue of Robert E. Lee. And this isn't the first time that somebody or a university or organization has removed a Confederate statue from its property. And this has been a long-going debate about whether we should continue to commemorate the Confederacy or not. I know that, you know, for decades of my life, there's been discussion about getting rid of the Confederate flag from a lot of the states' flags that were part of the Confederacy. And now we're moving on to getting rid of some of the monuments. So the whole event turned into a violent, you know, uprising where there was channeling of memes from Ku Klux Klan and Nazi propaganda. It looked like a lot of the events were organized around Nazi type rallies, and a lot of the speeches and a lot of the things that I've at least seen on the internet, as far as, you know, CNN or some of the other news organizations, have shown them, you know, marching with burning torches, and you know, they're trying to recreate a white supremacist ideology, basically. And so if their protest was against the removal of the statue, they're doing so by demonstrating white supremacist and neo-Nazi behaviors. So, you know, to counter that, the people of Charlottesville, the majority of whom are, you know, live in a college town, and many of them are liberal, decided that they would organize their own counter protest because this is their community. I mean, the people of Charlottesville who set up the counter protest were not coming in by the busload or by the plane full like the white supremacists. They're the people who actually represent that community, and they decided to organize their own protest to try and, you know, stop this kind of thing from rubbing their name in the dirt. So, you know, I don't know the full details. I'm looking at the news, and it doesn't seem like they're really forthcoming. And then all the, you know, pseudo news or news like organisms on the internet are taking and spinning this in a different way. But end of the story, one of the supremacists appears to have driven their car right through a crowd of and protesters, ended up killing one of them and hurting dozens of them. And because there was, you know, violence all throughout the streets of Charlottesville for the last couple of days, the police were monitoring it. It's unclear how involved the police were in stopping violence, but we do know that a police helicopter went down and two of the police officers died. I mean, the whole thing is spiraling out of control. The governor and the mayor declared a state of emergency. Charlottesville is, you know, trying to deal with an invasion of white supremacists. Mm-hmm. Now, going back to the heritage, because that's what we do. You know, we as CRMers are the ones who help, you know, get the factual foundation for protecting archaeological resources or saying that those resources are not valuable enough to be protected. You know, we play a role in this entire process. You know, we don't play a role in commemorating the Robert E. Lee statue there at the University of Virginia, but through our actions, the things that we decide that should be protected, the things that are considered significant, those are the kind of things that we have, as experts, said are valuable enough that our society should try to keep. In some cases, like the case here, the communities don't actually, in fact, agree. They don't want to have another monument, or they don't want to have another archaeological site. And so most of the time, that's worked out in courts or through other legal means, or we do some kind of mitigation to the damage or something. It usually doesn't turn into a violent, bloody battle in the streets of a city over removing a statue or creating a national monument. So, you know, as far as I feel, you know, this is something that matters to us. For the longest time, you know, I personally, and many others that I know, kind of laughed at the neo-Nazis and, you know, thought that they were a fringe group. And they don't speak for white people. They're talking about reclaiming white heritage, but I know a lot of white people who are sickened by this entire process. And so, you know, there's more than white people are not a monolithic, you know, group. They have, you know, many different feelings and different beliefs. And this is just a small group of all the white people who have decided to take it upon themselves to come to Charlottesville and try to tell the people that live there what to do with their own heritage. So we may, if we don't live in Virginia, look at it and be shocked and, you know, maybe saddened by the deaths and you know, just basically depressed by the way that some group people among our society feel. But this is the kind of stuff that we need to think about. We have to actually have some of this stuff going around in the debates that we have with each other about how can we address this, or what is our role in this entire process.
Right. You know, we were talking before the show. I lived in the South for a while in South Carolina, and and then visited North Carolina a lot. So around the area a lot. And then I lived in Georgia as well for grad school. So I'm very familiar with monuments to the Confederacy and not monuments that were put up. Like I'm all for small towns that have been around since the 1860s. Like not taking down their monuments that were put up in the 1870s, let's say, that say, oh, look at our fallen dead. You know, we got to, you know, let's put up a thing. They fought bravely for us or whatever, even if they were fought on the losing side. That's a historical thing. And I think the site, because of its antiquity, is historic, not just the thing. But when you look at the monuments that were put up 10 years ago or 15 years ago, or hell, even 30 or 40 years ago, that's the kind of thing that I think we need to really look at. And there was a comment that Sonia put up here in our background Skype chat from somebody online on Facebook, saying how they're actually trying to quote Tom King, and Tom King is a well-known regulatory expert and heritage expert in cultural resource management and archaeology. And his books are read by pretty much everyone who's an archaeologist, you know, in one way or another. And he's saying, the quote is saying that Tom says that the study of culture has to consider the current culture for which our work serves, and these Confederate monuments are no longer serving our evolving culture. And it goes on a little bit, but I think personally for me that's an incredibly ignorant way to look at what Tom King may have said. Because I've talked to Tom King a lot about stuff like this, and he's on the side of history, and so am I. So while I don't think we should personally, we shouldn't have statues to, I mean, any country that lost a war. I mean, we shouldn't have permanent statues, or displays honoring them on public grounds, on federal buildings, on, you know, anything like that. The one caveat to that is, like, I visited the, I think it was the Brown v. Board National Park site, and it's where some of that stuff went down. I think that's what it was. But anyway, that's a place where you can go in an appropriate setting with appropriate dialogue behind it, not sanitizing dialogue, but honest dialogue that says, hey, this is what happened here. Let's learn from this and let's move on. Here are some artifacts from this. Here are some stories from this, and here's what happened. And I think that's how we should look at the Civil War. We should look at the Civil War and any other time in our history that was really negative for us, as let's learn from those experiences. Let's put those in a place where we can learn from those, and let's not put them up on public grounds. Those statues shouldn't be sitting there. So I agree with the taking down of that statue, but put it back up in a museum. You know, it's like we're also mentioning in the back chat, should the Romans take down statues of Zeus? Should we destroy ancient Puebloan ruins because they represented a different religion or some sort of history? Should we not record Native American religious sites because they don't fit with our own? You know, all that stuff is part of our history. And I'll just end my little rant with this. There's two things here. There's things we can control and things we can't control. And one of the things we can't control is history itself, or we shouldn't anyway. We can't control what already happened is what I mean by that. All we can do is learn from it and move on. So what we can control is how we learn from it and how we move on. And that's what museums, national parks, things like that are for putting these things in their place and saying, look here, this is what happened. Let's either do this again if it was good or not do it again if it wasn't, but let's learn from it either way. So, Sonia, you had some pretty strong comments on these issues when we were leading up to this, and I haven't followed much in the Skype chat because it derails me. So let's hear your rant.
I gotta say I've been pretty fired up and I've been angry. I get upset periodically, but I don't get angry very often. Mm-hmm. I'm disappointed. I've always considered our populace, the U.S. populace, to be a relatively educated and a progressive group. Now, obviously, we're not looking at everybody here. We're looking at us as a general group. I'm stunned. I'm simply stunned and horrified that this type of behavior is taking place. I don't know what to say. You know, I'm angry about it. That now, just because I'm angry doesn't necessarily mean that I'm going to go out and wield a torch and a pitchfork and murder someone by driving down by driving quickly down a road, or taking down a helicopter, or carrying, you know, tons of guns out in public and dressed in military fatigues. I'm not going to do that, because I try to consider myself more as a educated, calm. Well, calm's probably not the right word right now. As someone who is simply has to take a step back and go, okay, what's going on here, and what can I do to remedy it? And I think to myself, there's nothing that I personally can do alone to take care of this. I mean, people, and there are so many of us who just kind of take a step back now and go, well, there's nothing I can do. Well, son of a biscuit, how's that? There's a lot of things that we can do if we kind of step back and together, and then go, you know what, this is unacceptable. And there are a lot of our senators who are actually taking a stand. And I'm not talking Democratic senators, I'm talking Republican senators as well. They've actually stepped up and said, you know what, this is not acceptable behavior. The response from our leadership has not been acceptable. This is what we have to say about it. This is what we're going to do about it. And I'm hoping that we as a population can support our senators, whether they be conservative or liberal, and move forward with something like that. Does the United States, do members of this country have free speech? Yes. But is hate speech considered part of free speech? Is it really? Should it be?
Right.
I don't know. I can't answer that question because I don't see it from all sides.
Sorry to jump in, but generally hate speech is not considered protected speech.
Well, thank goodness, because it is. That's what this was. And what I'm curious to know is, why the hell would this hate speech from, I don't know, hundreds of supporters, thousands of supporters? I don't know how many there were. Why was that tolerated? Why was it tolerated at all? If it's a big congregation of hate speakers, why did it even take place in the beginning, to begin with? Why was it permitted? Oh, because it was originally touted as a peaceful demonstration. A peaceful demonstration with people carrying torches and pitchforks is not a peaceful demonstration. Now, there are situations back in the 60s when a large groups of people came together and fought for civil rights. There's a difference between civil rights and putting people down, putting people back where they were in the 1860s, 1850s. You know, there's a big difference between moving forward and taking a step back, and I'm furious. I mean, I know I keep repeating myself, but I don't know where to go with all this.
Yeah.
And I can definitely tell you that you got me fired up. Not you personally, but these people got me fired up. And what are they waiting for now? Are they waiting for me to come after them?
Right.
Well, I would rather do it through the law and through proper channels than going out and running down some poor woman in the street.
Mm-hmm.
It's ridiculous. That was foolish.
Yeah.
And that was not good for their cause.
Okay, well, we're going to take our first break, and I'm going to try to fix some of this crackling noise you might be hearing. While you're listening to this podcast, hopefully you're not hearing much of it because I fixed it in post, but I would like to point out the times we live in. If I noticed right, the torches that they were carrying were actually like tiki torches, probably from Hobby Lobby, probably supplied by Hobby Lobby. I'm just going to go ahead and say that. They can sue me. Anyway, we'll be back in 30 seconds with more about this topic.
This episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast is made possible by Codify Incorporated. Codify is a California benefit corporation that can help you with your digital archaeological needs. Visit codify.com today to find out how Codify can help you go paperless in 2017. That's www.codify.com. Now back to the show.
All right, we're back. And this is a fiery topic, and I hope we get some good constructive comments and dialogue started because of this. Well, at least continued, because people are already talking about it. But Bill, you had a comment before we went to break. What do you have to say in response to Sonia or something in addition?
Well, I mean, the first thing that the first thing we have to remember is this entire dialectic between white people and blacks and Native Americans and all that stuff was created for exactly this kind of reason, for the white people and others who are getting actually trampled upon by capitalism to feel like they were not. Not only to feel like that they weren't, you know, the losers of the whole bargain, but that they were better than the others who were actually even bigger losers. So, you know, going back to the very beginning of the continent, once the rich aristocrats who were given these massive land grants from England or France or wherever else, once they realized that the poor whites and the, you know, freed slaves and indentured servants and the other people they had impressed and forced to come over to the North America, once they realized that they had a lot in common, they generated this racial dialectic. And it's worked, you know, beautifully throughout the entire history of the country. They've always been able to play upon this separation and unfounded basis of differences between people, so that poor whites who are right now suffering, you know, more than I'd say, you know, many others in our society, uneducated poor whites are suffering from, you know, drug epidemic, loss of their jobs, a loss of livelihood, living in polluted communities, and a further erosion of their chances out through education. You know, they're desperate, they're frustrated, and the white privilege that they used to get now, after this many years of civil rights and, you know, more equality, they're starting to actually see that whole, you know, privilege that they used to get by just simply being white. That's all eroding. So what you're seeing now is the backlash, the fire of those who are ultimately on the short end of the stick. And so, you know, I don't really actually know very many people because we self-segregate ourselves through life. I don't actually have a lot of poor white friends. Mm-hmm. But the ones that I still have, yeah, you know, they're maybe, because they're from Idaho, not so willing to go to Virginia and, you know, pull out pitchforks and stuff, but they agree with the alt-right meme. And they do agree that their culture and society has been taken away. I mean, these are people that I've grown up with and I've known for 30, 40 years, almost 40 years now. They actually believe that their country is falling apart and it's being taken away from them, as if that could even happen, right? So for years, we didn't pay attention. And now the racism and the racial dialectic that's created in this country is starting to come back up like a powder keg and explode.
Yeah. Yeah. I've got some comments on that, but I'll wait because Stephen hasn't had a chance to give his piece yet. So Stephen, what does all of Canada think? No, Stephen doesn't speak for Canada, but go ahead.
Yeah, no, I am not Canadian. I'm just in Canada. And, I think that makes it kind of weird for me because I'm so removed from things that are happening in the U.S. As remote as, you know, someone from Nevada might be from, you know, Charlottesville, I probably feel just as remote or a little bit more because, you know, it's not easy for me to just pick up the phone and call the legislature, you know, my representatives or, you know, stuff like that. So like the amount of weight that my opinion carries as far as, you know, being an American goes, may not be quite as great because I don't have a physical presence there, right? I can't just show up and march around on the square or anything else. And to that end, it kind of turns into, you know, what can you do? You know, if you can't just show up and, you know, and you know, lend actual physical support, what can you do? And you know, in the short time that we've had to think about this sort of thing, you know, one is, you know, money is still appreciated. You know, you have the Southern Poverty Legal Center? What is it? Law Center? Money to, you know, there are a lot of avenues that you can, you know, remotely have influence. But I think another part is you know, just, you know, that level of change, you know, needs to, you know, be within us all, right? You know, it has to kind of start at home. And, you know, try to, you know, basically try to, you know, fight the good fight, live the good life. And, you know, if you see things going down that you know, you need to take a stand against, you know, it kind of falls on you if you're the one there to do it. And in certain respects, in many respects, I think that Canada is not all that different. You know, especially being in Alberta, that, you know, the prairie provinces are pretty conservative politically, mm-hmm. and socially, and there are still racial issues, and some of them are pretty fiery. I think that some of it gets aired a little bit better, discussed a little bit more. But, you know, those issues are still there. There's still plenty of racial issues. I will say that I think segregation is not as big a deal here. And part of that is the way that Canada has dealt with immigration. But, you know, those issues remain the same. But I kind of want to go back to something that Bill was just saying. He's talking about, you know, the perceptions of the loss of, you know, poor rural white culture. And that's an interesting thing if we want to approach that from, you know, like, I mean, ostensibly this is a CRM podcast, and so maybe we should actually talk about cultural management. You know, how do we deal with that? If you know, is that cultural thing just a fake? Is that, you know, just, you know, a happy story that, you know, people told themselves to feel good? If what we're relying on to, you know, determine like cultural importance is, you know, the relationships of historical precedents as it applies to like our cultural identities, you know, how do we work with that? You know, where does that fall in with, you know, the Confederate statuary and stuff like that?
Yeah, one of the ways, so there's two things here. For years and years, we've spent our time showing that people in the past were humans, that Indians were not aliens who created pyramids or mounds, that they're actual humans, just like white people are humans, right? So going back to that dialectic, the thought was that Asians and Native Americans and African people were not actually humans. And anthropology spent years and years proving that blacks were a less level of human, and Asians were less, and Native Americans were less. And by them having not the same level of humanness, it made it easier for Euro-Americans to dispossess them of their liberty, their rights, their land, whatever they felt like they needed to do or wanted to do. They just did it because it was justified by the Bible or by science. And we as anthropologists, that's our heritage. We help create that. So since cultural resources, having all these archaeological resources and also historic buildings, I mean, let's not forget the first real historic preservation campaign were the people who were trying to save George Washington's home at Mount Vernon. So, you know, there has been a disproportionate protection, especially when it comes to architectural resources, of the things that went along with, you know, rich whites or Euro-Americans. So we have all these house museums, plantations, whole neighborhoods. You know, a lot of the people that lived in those were white, and we've saved those as historic districts. When we get to the archaeology, we've learned more about what it was like to be a slave, what it was like to be a Chinese worker, what it's been like to be a Native American. And all of that makes those people seem more human. And in a world where there has to be winners or losers, you know, just like in capitalism, where there has to be someone who loses in order for white people to win, they can't have, there's no space for more humans. There's only space for white people. So if you do what we've been doing, showing them the humanness of the past, of people who used to live, it makes it more difficult for them to discriminate. And the difficulty that comes along with trying to reason out the, you know, the way that the world is from a perspective of diversity or a world where others, what they say actually matters, that's what these people are rebelling against. The security of knowing that you're white and it was going to make you to the top of whatever community you lived in, well, that's no longer true. So now what do you have? And it's really like a grasp for desperation. So in the long run, we kind of just have to keep doing what we're doing, because before, most white Americans thought those things, that blacks weren't humans. Now only some do. And I can only hope that by the time my children are my age, almost no whites believe that. Almost all people understand that you know, human beings are humans. It's a shame that it's going to take like 300 years for them to finally figure that out. But what else can we do? All we can do is just keep showing those pasts and trying to be as inclusive and honest about what actually happened in the past. And, you know, if these guys start seeing this coming from all sides, it's going to weather not just them down, but their children and their children's children. And as we just continue to show that there was a past for others besides white people, it's just going to weaken this position to the point where there's just not really anyone left to support it. At least that's what I hope.
Yeah, I think this seems like the common denominator for every single one of these discussions. Like, Stephen, you mentioned the prairie provinces being a little more conservative, and, you know, it's similar with the same prairie states that we have, and things like that are more conservative in the United States. It seems like it's all a problem of education, and it's not just like, let's put out another PBS special. It's education on a local level. You know, people look at the TV and they look at movies and radio and stuff like that as separate. You know, that's in a box somewhere and that's happening somewhere else. That's not happening in my house. It's not happening. That's all fiction. That's all these other things. That's not happening in my neighborhood. But, you know, those of us that live in cities and those of us live in more populated areas, sure, that kind of xenophobia for somebody who's a little more introverted can actually get really bad. They could just lock themselves inside of their home all day. But a lot of these people, the reason they turn blue on elections, the reason they're a little more liberal is because they're around different cultures and different attitudes and things like that all the time. And I think, I don't know, I think that's, again, that's, I've said this before, that's one of the reasons I wanted to do the expand this podcast into the Archaeology Podcast Network, because we had so many things to say and so many different things to put out there from an educational standpoint that I hope people can find it. You know, people in those prairie states and the prairie provinces and the South and all over the world can find these and listen to them for free. And that helps. That's one tiny, 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 tiny little bump of education that I hope people get when they hear our stuff. So anyway, it's education. It all comes down to education to me. I don't know.
No, I absolutely agree with that. And that's really where cultural resources come in to play, because we know now more about the past in North America, at least, than we ever have at any point in time. And even the places that we once, you know, saw as one thing, like Casa Grande or the Chaco Canyon, we once saw those as these great, you know, achievements of Native Americans. Now we're starting to realize that they're actually, you know, a human achievement, that this was the way that the Hohokam were surviving in an ever-changing and really fragile desert. They had, you know, moved to the place where they're building great houses, right? The people in Chaco Canyon, they ended up having to abandon it because of environmental change and because of, you know, several other reasons, and they traveled throughout the Southwest. When those places were named as monuments, they were just kind of cool buildings, right? Now we actually know that they're a sign of human beings' resilience, specifically Native Americans. And it's the same thing with learning more about slave cabins. I mean, not far from Charlottesville, Montpelier and those other Monticello.
Yeah.
They're involving the ancestral African Americans that had slaves that were ancestors there in the excavations. And those people are, you know, participating, you know, on the ground in heritage conservation of their own heritage. That's the kind of thing that the alt-right is afraid of. They're afraid of that kind of stuff. They're afraid of, you know, opening up the world and, you know, realizing that there's more people at the table than they actually ever imagined. And I think, you know, the biggest core of this whole thing is that whole winner take all society capitalism, where, you know, the only way that we can survive is for us to crush other people, or, you know, well, we got to just move these jobs away because we just have to do it. There's no other way at all that we can keep this mining town, or there's no way that we can keep Detroit alive. We've got to just take the jobs and we've got to move away. I mean, if you're one of those people who, you know, your livelihood was moved away and you were taught for generations to just rely in this company, in this corporation, that they'll always take care of you. I mean, that's like, you know, one of your parents dying, essentially. You don't have a hope. You got to figure it out all on your own. And the shockwaves of that transformation over the last 100 years or so, you know, every time it gets extremely bad, like it is right now, these violent outbursts are exactly what you end up seeing. Protests, outbursts. So, like in a bigger world, there has to be more inclusivity, not only with, you know, just society, but also trying to make our businesses to the point where they actually are community assets that they give back to the community more than the old Ford plant used to.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a, they keep talking about the, you know, the, I guess, washing out the white heritage from history, the alt-right and the white nationalists do. They keep saying, you know, hey, you're getting rid of all of our white history, blah, blah, blah. We're not getting rid of anything. We're just adding to it. And if you look at, like you mentioned, Bill, you look at the Hohokam and you look at Chaco Canyon, look at all these other things. And there hasn't been a single, I guess, culture, for lack of a better word, on the entire planet that has persisted to now from when they started, right? I mean, things just blend. Yeah. Things blend, things die off, things go out of favor. They mix, they do things like that. And it's no different now. You know, we had, I mean, they're not even considering Native American culture, which we've pretty much completely obliterated, except for where they want it to happen, you know, in their own little families. We've just taken that off the map for North America. And then replaced it with white European culture. And now that's being mixed and added to. I mean, arguably, it's been happening all along because we've accepted pretty much anybody into our borders, which is great. But now it's, for some reason, it's just becoming, I guess, more and more prominent, probably because of all of our, you know, political things going on. But and people are starting to take notice, but it's just a mixing. It's just a mixing and a blending and a changing and a continuing of our culture and everything that we're doing. And by our, I mean everybody's, you know, I mean, there's no single person. So,
well, yeah, I mean, going back to the monolithicness of whiteness, though, they're talking about us, you know, washing away white history.
Right.
Well, that's not true, man.
No, it's not.
I mean, since I moved to the Bay Area, I'm pretty sure most of the white people here do not think that the Confederacy or any of this kind of neo-Nazi stuff is okay. Actually, you know, in Berkeley, there's fistfights the other way where, you know, that stuff is just not okay to say or to do here. So they're talking about getting rid of white history. Well, that's not true. We're only trying to get rid of the history of white supremacy.
Right.
That's what it's all about.
Right. Okay. Well, we're going to take our last break and try to wrap this up. Although, you know, the opinions on both sides, all this whole entire topic, we could talk all day on this thing. So, but I hope that people are listening to this and then commenting and not just looking at whatever title I give this episode and commenting on that, because that's what usually happens. But listen to this and give us some comments. But for now, though, we'll be back in 30 seconds. Stay tuned.
Hey, podcast fans, check out the ARC365 podcast at www.arcpodnet.com/ARC365. That's ARCH365 for your daily dose of archaeology. Each episode is less than 15 minutes long, and we have some great guests recording about awesome archaeology. We also try to throw in some definitions and basic archaeological information. So check out the 365 Days of Archaeology podcast only in 2017 at www.arcpodnet.com/ARC365 today. Find us also on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Google Music by typing ARC365 into the search. Now back to the show.
Okay, we're back. And as I said before the break, we're going to try to wrap this up. So, Sonia, I think I'm going to throw it back to you because we had a lot to say about these things, and you've been fairly active on the chat in the background, so I'm bringing you to the foreground. What are your thoughts on this? I mean, you live in a state where there's lots of interesting cultural things going on. You live in a state with, you know, 10 to 15,000 years of history, but also a very recent history based on religion and a particular culture that took over the state kind of in a hurry, in a fury. I mean, so yep. Using that as your base, you know, what's your thoughts on all this?
how do you mean? Like, my thoughts on how quickly culture integrates or doesn't integrate, as it were.
I guess. I mean, what do Mormons say over there about all this stuff going on? Because I think I think they got to be kind of sitting on the edge of their seat with some of this stuff, because if other people come by and say, well, I'm not Mormon, and there's a pretty big non-Mormon group in, yes. crowd in Utah, in Salt Lake City.
That's true.
I mean, and they're completely the opposite direction, and they have the best coffee shops and craft breweries too. But,
That's true. That's also very true.
But well, do you okay. see, yeah, go ahead.
Full disclosure. I'm not a member of the LDS Church. I'm actually a German Lutheran. With a long history in the United States. My family came here in the 1860s, 1870s. When I say here, I mean the United States, not Utah. There's actually a ranch up in the Dakotas. You could Google it. It's called the Hutmacher Ranch. So nice. We've been here. We're actually Germans from Russia. So I got all sorts of strange history, if you want to talk about kids who got tormented for being Nazis as when we were kids, that you can chat with me. I'm happy to talk about that. That's not fun. It's bullying, blah, blah, blah. My family is also Midwestern primarily, obviously, but we have a lot of Southern influence in terms of how, like, my parents grew up with their perceptions to people of color, other cultural groups in their neighborhoods, things like that. When I moved to Utah, I moved here back in 2000. So I've been here for, 17 years now? And it was understandable that it could be a little bit of a culture shock. But as an anthropologist, I found it very interesting, or archaeologist, depending on how you want to look at it. Most of us are trained as anthropologists first. I took it as an opportunity to learn about another American culture with a very distinct religious background. People in Utah are not too much different than the rest of the United States, but religion is a very, very important part of our society here. Not being one of the religious members, it made it a little challenging, but being open-minded was really helpful. One of the things in Utah, we came here, or we, Utahns, LDS Utahns came in because they were running away from persecution. A lot like whites and came to the United States because they were fleeing religious persecution. Living here has been good. It's a wonderful place to live. That said, I mean, I can't speak for all Utahns, and again, I'm not a member of the predominant religion. I don't know, and everything just happened for us yesterday, so I don't know what the church has to say, and I would certainly be happy to report that. If I did hear something. But even Orrin Hatch has come out and said, what's going on in Charlottesville is not cool. We don't condone this. This is not what our society is about. And I would say that, I mean, Utahns have, we're predominantly white here. Lots of blonde hair and blue eyes. not everyone, obviously, but we also tend to be, I don't know if open is the right word, but considerate of some things. We recognize persecution. We recognize hurtfulness and what's going on. It wasn't too long ago, a little more than 100 years ago, that the members of the LDS Church were chased out of Missouri and Illinois with pitchforks and torches. So, I can't say a lot about what Utahns feel because, again, it just happened. But I can imagine, and I would be more than happy to correct myself if it comes out differently.
Mm-hmm.
I would definitely say that we probably are upset, and we can sympathize, and we want to make a change. We just don't know how. And what we need is a leadership that can tell us how we can help. And I don't know, that's probably a long answer to a question that was intended to be very short, but, you know, it's for us, as Utahns, we want people to live in harmony. We want to have families that are indefinite and forever. You know, we want people to love one another, and we don't have that. You know, I mean, we can't say that our culture here in Utah is perfect, but you know, a lot of the homeless in the United States run to Utah in the winter because they know they'll be taken care of.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's saying something, right?
Yeah. And it'll be interesting to see how this plays out across the country with communities that are, you know, that have somewhat polarizing attitudes towards things, even if they're getting along in harmony right now, but they're still very polarized. We see how they go. So we're wrapping this up for a few minutes here. Bill, you've got one last comment on what Sonia was saying.
Yeah, that's cool, Sonia, about Utah. And coming from Idaho, I do know that Mormons are definitely aware of discrimination, whether it's from others who are not Mormon or by just, you know, people who don't believe that Mormons are actually Christians. I mean, that's a fairly common thing. But when it comes to cultural resources and this whole topic, the one thing that I want everyone to know or to think about the next time that you work is, you know, you're working on somebody's heritage. And if you end up working on a site that's, you know, associated with neo-Nazis or Confederates or whatever, it is also your duty to do justice to that history and not just play into the meme that they want to hear, but actually tell the truth about the diversity behind, you know, our United States in the Civil War. Not all the white people who fought for the Confederacy were anti-slavery or not all whites that fought on the Confederacy were for slavery because it made it harder for them. If you're a poor white, you maybe were defending your homeland rather than fighting to keep more free labor in the area where you're already struggling to survive. And all the people in the Union, you know, they're not all for equality. A lot of those people didn't even think blacks were humans. They just were, you know, fighting because a group of the country decided to split off and they were fighting for the unity of the country. So if you're working on a site that's a poor white Southern site, I mean, you should, rather than just blowing through it and saying, yeah, well, this is just an 1830s, you know, tenant farmer, go ahead, make this road go right through it. Maybe you should spend a little bit of time thinking about what it was like to be poor and white in the 1830s with slaves all around you. Mm-hmm. And tell the truth of that history. Let that history be known to these kind of alt-right neo-Nazi revisionists that want to change white history, because the truth is they also suffered just like everyone else who was poor, just like blacks. The only people who weren't suffering were the ones who were on the dollar bill.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we're going to switch topics just for the last few minutes of this in a second, but, you know, I'll finish up with my comment on this. I've worked with a number of people in the past, not very many, quite frankly, which is nice. But I have worked with people that had very strong, ultimately religious views on history, and it clouded their judgment on how they recorded stuff. And this specifically was in Utah, these particular cases that I can think of. And, it's shocking. I see us as archaeologists. I see us as more like doctors that have sworn an oath. You know, they swear an oath to take care of and do no harm and to protect and help people that, that come into their need, regardless of, you know, race, sex, religion, whatever that may be. And I think it's the same for us when we're archaeologists, especially CRM archaeologists, where we don't really get to choose what we work on. We go where the jobs are, and we go out there and we say, we record everything as faithfully as we can to the science, from the scientific method. So, you know, we record everything out there that we see, and we write it down as we see it, and we don't make any judgments. We don't make any determinations. We can make interpretations later on, but we don't make any judgments while we're in the field. Record everything as we see it. And that's my little PSA for that. You know, don't bring in your own biases, because it doesn't matter. You're recording somebody else's history, and that's your job. Don't bring in your interpretations of the history while you're sitting there in the field and say, well, this can't possibly be this because I've always believed this my whole life. Just record what you see. And get that in the record, because that's probably going to be it's probably going to be gone in a while. So anyway, I wish we could devote more time to this, but we've got to move on. And I want to move to health and safety a little bit. Just real quick, because something that also happened last week, and I believe it was on Thursday, we'll have a link to the article in the show notes, although there's very little information. But a woman was apparently killed while monitoring on a, I think it was a road construction project up in Canada. And I actually don't even remember where in Canada, but I think it was Eastern Canada, something like that, Ontario or something rings a bell. But anyway, we'll have a link in the show notes. But either way, we don't know the circumstances. We don't know what was happening to make that happen. Did something go out of control? Was she in the wrong place? I don't know what happened. But the point is to make people aware of, you know, be hyper aware of these things. I mean, I'm guilty of this too, but we tend to look at monitoring gigs as kind of like, I don't know, let's be honest. We tend to look at them as kind of easy gigs where we just go out there, we're watching stuff, you know, and then when the bulldozers get down below the level that we need to be concerned about, we kind of go off in our own little heads and, you know, some, maybe even pulling out a book, maybe doing whatever you're going to do and not really paying attention, but you're working around sometimes massive big equipment, you're working in dangerous areas. When you're monitoring, there's construction happening and they have you wear hard hats and safety gear and all that stuff for a reason. So, you know, just be careful and be aware. And like I said, she could have been doing everything right for all I know, and something still happened, and that's still possible. You never know what's going to happen out there. But this is just a, you know, if you hadn't heard about this, just one more thing to say, hey, let's keep your head on a swivel, we used to say in the Navy when I worked on the flight deck of an aircraft carrier. You always got to be looking around. I mean, even at 3 o'clock in the morning when we were up there and nothing was going on, somebody could be swinging something around and you could get knocked off the side of the ship 80 feet to the ocean. And it all happens in a half a second and you were planning on it. So, guys, what do you think about this attitude towards monitoring just in general? Like, again, I'm not putting anything on this woman because we don't know the circumstances, but people's attitudes toward monitoring in general and you know, as being a you know, a relaxing sort of day off.
Well, I remember watching a presentation that someone was talking about monitors and they were saying how a lot of times they're the least, you know, they're like the greenhorn entry-level person that they send out there,
right?
Because they cost the least amount of money. So, you know, like the article is really brief. I couldn't find hardly any information on this, but
no. No, it's Canada. They're respectful of the family.
Well, perhaps the person just actually didn't know, right? Like if you didn't have proper training and you barely even started working, you probably don't really think about the fact that a Traco is a powerful machine. It crushes, you know, buildings for a living, and you're right by it. So if you didn't get any training, you know, I can see how you'd get hurt really easily. Starting off, you know, I did a fair amount of monitoring, and you know, I don't think I really actually recognized the danger.
Yeah. Sonia.
Yeah. So from a business standpoint, I'd like to add that, according to workers' compensation insurance companies, monitoring near construction equipment is one of the most dangerous tasks that you could do for cultural resources. It is one of the things that raises our workers' compensation insurance costs and thereby our overall costs to conduct business. But in terms of health and safety for my crews, I personally want to make sure that every single one of my crew members and you, by default, are safe. I mean, I want you to know that standing on the edge of a trench is not safe because that trench could fall in. And depending on how deep that trench is, you could be buried in a heartbeat. They could pull a track hoe in there and pull you out, but they're probably not going to pull you out alive.
Yeah.
Even next to a 3-foot trench could kill you. So stay safe. Always have your PPE on, always near heavy equipment. Even if that heavy equipment isn't moving, you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know what's going to start up. Always have your PPE on. Always make sure you have eye contact with that operator anytime you approach. Make sure you have hand signals in place. So that he knows you're going to approach the bucket.
Mm-hmm.
Do not stand behind a track hoe or a caterpillar, anything. Always stay in eye contact with that operator. Again, we don't know what happened to this woman. We don't know. So we can't really comment on it. But watch out for things. Keep your eye on the bucket, on the body of that track hoe. Watch overhead weight, you know, everything. Workers' comp claims for working your trenches and excavations is one of the most costly, and most accidents happen in these areas. When I first started, I was doing monitoring for about 6 months or so, and it was the biggest snooze fest on the planet. I got so bored. I actually started volunteering to help the guys because I wanted to remain active and conscious of what was going on. But assisting someone else's company is actually considered a liability. Because you're doing a job that you weren't hired or trained to do.
Mm-hmm.
So don't even do that. We all want to pull out a book and read, or we want to stop in the summer and sit in the truck where it's air conditioned and take a nap or something. You need to stay awake. You need to stay conscious of what's going on around you. Some of these caterpillars can drive over your truck.
Yeah.
And
pretty
kill
quickly.
You. Yeah. Pretty quickly. And if you're not awake and conscious of what's going on around you, you'll get hurt. So I beg of you, as extensions of my crew, please take care of yourselves. Okay? Be watchful.
Right. Okay. Well, thanks for that, Sonia. And I'll just end with a really, really, really short story. I remember driving up onto a thing one time. It's like a project area when I was crew chiefing. And one of our guys was out monitoring because we were doing different phases all over the place. And it was on a mine site and they were creating a road. And this guy was walking behind an excavator, one of those road graders, not an excavator, a road grader, and looking at the ground behind the road grader as it was moving. And which is fine, but he was like 50 feet behind the road grader as it was moving, looking down at the ground. And if that guy decided to stop and back up, and let's say his backup alarm failed or something like that, it's already loud. You might even be wearing hearing protection. I can't remember if they were at the time, probably because it was a mine site. So all those things are happening, and quite frankly, you start tuning stuff out that you get used to, even loud sounds and things like that. You get into your own head, and you start tuning that other stuff out, and you don't realize he just backed up. And I think what another thing you said, Sonia, the eye contact thing, I've noticed so many people don't do that. And I think that comes from, and Stephen could probably say something to this, as a bicyclist, somebody who's done a lot of biking on the road, not nearly as much as Stephen has, but somebody who's been out there, you know, for my whole adult life, out biking in traffic and things like that, I don't make a move across an intersection or in front of a vehicle if they're stopped or something like that until I have eye contact with the driver. If you have eye contact, I go, you know, because then they see you, you know, then that's confirmed. If you don't have eye contact with the equipment operators, then you shouldn't make a move that could put you in danger. So we'll just end with that. And again, I know some people that listen to this knew the woman who was killed in Canada, just from some of the posts I've seen on Facebook and Instagram and things like that. So our thoughts go out to you guys and especially to her family. Because that's never a good situation for the company, for her coworkers, for her family. I mean, for the construction workers, for everybody. So everybody, keep your head on a swivel, like we said. Stay alert and stay alive. And again, leave your comments to anything we said today on the Facebook post, which is usually where we see these things. Or feel free to email us with your private comments. Thank you.
That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/CRM Arc Podcast. If you like the show and want to comment, please do. You can leave comments about this or any other episode on the website or on the iTunes page for the episode. You can also email me at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com or use the contact form on the podcast webpage. If you'd like us to answer a question on a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website or tweet your questions with the hashtag CRM Arc Podcast. podcast, or you can tag @arcpodnet in your tweet. Please share the link to the show wherever you saw it. If you share CRM archaeology-related items on Twitter or Facebook or anywhere else for that matter, be sure to use the hashtag CRMARC so the community can see and comment. If you'd like to subscribe to this podcast, you can do so on iTunes or on Stitcher Radio. You can also type the name of the podcast into your favorite podcasting app and subscribe that way. Don't forget to go over to iTunes and leave a review of the show. It helps us get noticed so more people can find our podcast and benefit from the content. Also, send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about. Also, please consider donating to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Your donations help fund our bandwidth and contribute to our editing costs.
Thanks to everyone for joining me this week. Thanks also to the listeners for tuning in, and we'll see you in the field. Goodbye.
Bye.
Adios.
See ya.
This show is produced by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle.
And edited by Richie Cruz.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.